From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Caudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Wednesday, so that means it's time for our Dr. Roundtable with Dr. David Pate. He is, of course, the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, and he's joining us today to talk about all things public health. Remember, if you have a question for Dr. Pate, you can always send us an email, Boise at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Hi, Dr. Pate.
Hi, Gemma.
So, Dr. Pate, I want to begin our time today talking about this latest iteration of the bird flu. Now, this is something over the last couple of weeks you've brought to our attention because there is a dairy farm here in Idaho where some dairy cows have been infected with the bird flu. But, Dr. Pate, there was a big article in the New York Times that was just released, and I am stunned by what I read, because the headline even says bird flu is infecting more animals. What does this mean for the United States? And within this article, Dr. Pate, they have a timeline that goes back to 2021 of this most recent bird flu. I was stunned.
Well, yeah. And of course, if you're stunned, think about the general public, who probably pays even less attention to this. So you're absolutely right. I mean, this is something that I've been observing in the scientific community being discussed. I haven't seen anything until recently in the popular media, but I've been watching this and thinking, my goodness, this is really quite concerning, because typically with avian influenza, it infects waterfowl. They get it from eating things where the virus is in freshwater, in ponds, in creeks, in shallow lakes, those kinds of things. And they then transmit it to domestic poultry and domestic birds. And we usually see this because it's highly, highly lethal in birds. And you will be immediately clued off to it, because all of a sudden there's a bunch of carcasses laying around. They die and we'll see it. And then when it starts happening, then they start culling chickens or wherever this outbreak is. And of course, we experienced it last year with egg prices going up because we were culling so large numbers of domestic hens that were laying eggs. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we expect. Well, what started happening, as you mentioned, back 2.5-3 years ago, we started seeing this pop up in mammals. Now, that's unusual, but it has happened sporadically and in very isolated cases, because the avian influenza virus, or so-called, what most people will call bird flu, it has special receptors, and most mammals don't have those receptors. What we worry about is pigs do. And if this gets into pigs, it could be a game changer, because just like what we've been talking about with the SARS-CoV-2 virus that's caused COVID, and people have gotten to see how it mutates frequently, influenza viruses are also RNA viruses, and they mutate a lot. But what we saw since 2023 with the SARS-CoV-2 virus is we started seeing recombinations, where it wasn't just that a specific part of the genetic code was substituted with something else. Two viruses were exchanging some of their genetic material, so we'd see lots of big changes in the virus. And those were the ones that were named starting with an X, and everybody will remember all those series of iterations. Well, influenza viruses are noted for doing something similar. It's called a reassortment, where they just swap segments of their of the genetic material. And the concern is an avian influenza, which would really have trouble infecting humans, because about the only place we have that receptor is our eyes. So people would typically, that would be the route to getting it. But it doesn't transmit well in humans. But if it gets into pigs are ones that have both the bird receptors and the human receptors. And then we could have a situation where now it adapts where it could maybe transmit better to humans. And so when we started seeing this happen in mammals, as you were describing, to such a big degree, that really became alarming. Not a need mm-hmm. for panic, because there's still a long way for it to go before it would really cause a major problem in humans. But mm-hmm. what's been happening the last couple of years is evidence that it's making changes. And if we don't do something to interrupt it, we are increasing the risk that it is going to pose a threat to humans.
And what I want to make clear for folks who maybe, don't realize, the staggering amount of mammals that have died from this just in one year, I think going back to last year, if you look at this New York Times article, in Argentina alone, they had at least 24,000 South American seals die. They had more than 17,000 elephant seal pups die from this, Dr. Pate. And then when we look at the timeline, they're talking about, even in Maine, back in, summer of 2022, harbor seals and gray seals died along the coast of Maine. And researchers believe what happened is that these seals may have been infected by living near or eating sick and dead birds. I would assume that would have been the same in Argentina. And so this is spreading across the world, right, Dr. Pate? So fast forward now,
it is.
three and a half years, and it's in dairy farms here in the United States, and all of a sudden we're hearing about this. And
yeah.
Why is that?
Well, the span of different mammals that it's now infecting, mammals that we have not seen an avian influenza infect before, and the scope of it, just like the large numbers you're talking about. We've seen isolated cases, sporadic cases, but we haven't seen something like this. And now to have it show up, the first evidence was, and you're right, I started writing about it on my blog right away. I think it was March 25th. Was the first outbreak on a dairy farm. We've never seen that. And at that point, what was concerning and why I was raising a little bit of alarm is those birds that I said that they transmit this virus, they carry the virus and transmit, they're also migratory. So in March, when this was happening, it's not surprising we would see, if we're going to see an outbreak, we'd see it on Texas down in the south. But guess where those birds start heading in March, April, and May? They start heading up here. And then when I heard, oh my goodness, now we actually have a dairy farm in Idaho. Now that's concerning, because what that suggests is, and we do move cows around and cattle around too, and some of that goes down south for the winter. We had started bringing some of that cattle back. And so now, instead of worrying about the birds transmitted, now we became concerned, wait, are the cows themselves transmitting it, which would be a first. We've seen birds transmit it to some isolated mammals sporadically, but we've never seen then subsequent outbreaks from mammal to mammal. That's concerning. And we still don't know how. And this is why we have got to do more research on these things. We've got to do more publicity, because now the concern is, well, okay, what about the risks to cattle workers? Well, we had a cattle worker, a farm worker in Texas get infected. Thank God he's okay. Now, the mortality rate for this virus in the limited number of cases, all in all, a little less than 1,000 people have been infected. They're all people that have had really close contact with various animals that might be infected. So it's a small number, less than 1,000, but more than half have died from this. So this is a serious virus, and we need to be doing research. So now what we found is that the virus is in very high levels in the cow milk. And so there is a thought, and based on some evidence that the pasteurization process would probably kill that virus. But we need a lot of information. Number one, can a human be infected by avian influenza if it's in our food or in the milk? We don't know the answer to that question, to my knowledge. Number two, does the pasteurization process effectively kill the virus or kill enough of it that no one's going to get an infectious dose, an amount of virus that would be necessary to infect it? But I don't even know if we can get infected by ingestion. We need to answer that question. And the other questions are, is the virus changing in ways that accounts for what's going on now? And does that pose a greater risk to transmission to humans? And the USDA is being very slow in sending out and making public to our scientists that look at this, the sequences of the virus. And finally, how are the cows transmitting it to each other? We think that it's probably the milking machines that then get the virus because it's coming out of the udders into the milk. So, and then it's being transmitted to the next cow, but we don't know that. And a real concern is many countries have outlawed feeding chicken waste to cattle, but the United States hasn't. So are we taking now large numbers of poultry farms where maybe the virus is being shed into the waste, then reprocessing it, and now are we giving it to the cows? Is that how the cows are getting it? So we just have so many unanswered questions, and we've got to have more transparency and more information quickly.
Before we take a break, Dr. Pate, you said something about the USDA being slow. In fact, right now, they're only requiring volunteering testing of cows. And there's a quote by a researcher in this New York Times article that I appreciate. And it says, if we don't give it the panic, but we give it the respect and due diligence, I believe we can manage it. And is that kind of where you would say we are? Is we don't want to panic people, right? But at the same time, it's like, be aware of this, but also maybe step up what we're doing in the United States when it comes to testing for this, so we can try to confine it as much as possible.
Well, that's exactly right. There, first of all, there, as you said, there's absolutely no reason for panic. We are not having outbreaks of this virus in humans right now. Even the 1,000 people that I mentioned that have been infected, again, they're people that had very close contact with the animals, and we don't have evidence that they transmitted it on to people they live with, family members, others. So definitely no need for panic. On the other hand, also, it wouldn't be right to just bury our heads in the sand and not take this seriously and as something that could emerge to be a threat. And so this is precisely the time to study it, to understand what's going on, to develop our treatments if we need them, because we already have a head start on this. We know the kinds of drugs we can use to treat this. We also are very good at making influenza vaccines. We could make vaccines that would work for this. So even if it got to be a problem in humans, it still wouldn't be need for panic. But on the other hand, we need to learn now. We need to understand what's going on. And there's just not either we have to trust that the government's doing it, and I don't think that's necessarily wise based on what we've seen lately, or they need to get more transparent and tell us, what are they doing to study this? What have they learned? And the CDC and the federal government need to tell us, have we stocked up our national strategic stockpiles again? We had tremendous shortages during COVID. Have we stocked those up? Are we ready for the next threat, whether it's avian influenza or something else? We just aren't getting the kind of communication. And I'm afraid that our state and federal legislatures are spending too much time on stuff that doesn't affect average Americans, but yet not paying hardly any attention to these threats, which should merit their time.
Dr. Pate, I want to spend this next segment talking a little bit about Salzer Health. It's been almost a month since the Treasure Valley Medical Group put this on its website. Quote, as of March 29th, 2024, Salzer Health is no longer in business, unquote. Now, Salzer made this announcement in January that it is going to have to close its doors at all of its 11 sites. So this is employees, doctors, patients have been scrambling since then. In fact, the Idaho Statesman reported that 100,000 patients will have to find health care somewhere else. St. Alphonsus did pick up 3 Sulzer locations, and many of the Sulzer doctors are setting up their own practices. But with that said, there is still a huge gap in healthcare. So first off, Dr. Pate, what should Sulzer patients do if they find their doctor and their doctor's office is actually completely gone?
Yeah, well, the first thing is you need to establish with a new physician as soon as you can, even though there's probably going to be a significant delay until you can get in to see that doctor. Go ahead and make that appointment now, because that first visit is the most time-consuming one. That's where the new doctor is going to have to create a record, review your history, compile your medications, have all that stuff. But having done that, it now places you in their patient base. And then if you do get sick and need to be seen, much easier to be seen if you're already an established patient than if you're not. So number one, make that appointment now. Even if you're healthy, just go in for the checkup to establish with the physician. Second thing, in the interim, because it's likely going to be a while till you can get in, you don't know what's going to happen. So you need to be aware of where are your local hospitals, local emergency rooms, local urgent care, and you can even look at some of the virtual care options that if you got sick or if you got hurt and needed care, where you might go for care. So I would be prepared with all those things. Hopefully all those people that are already on medicines, hopefully you've already established and got a prescription to last you. We don't want people going off medicines. Of course, we got to worry about people that are pregnant and having needs for ongoing pregnancy care, but I'm hopeful that most of them have transitioned, but be proactive.
So how big of an impact is this influx of patients going to have on, I mean, really, we already have a strained healthcare system in the Treasure Valley. So I'm assuming this could be a fairly significant impact.
Well, it is. It's a very significant impact. I'm very pleased at how all the other healthcare providers are stepping up, St. Luke's, St. Al's, others, to try to help contain the damage from this. I am also delighted that quite a number of those physicians decided to stay and set up new practices, but it is absolutely going to be a strain on the healthcare system. I would imagine it would take at least a couple of years for us to fully absorb all of this and get back to even just where we were, because it's very difficult to recruit physicians, period, but it's especially difficult to recruit physicians to Idaho if they're not originally from Idaho. And so it's not only difficult, but it's also a lengthy process to relocate physicians. So I think this is going to take some time until everybody can be fully absorbed. But obviously, I think our healthcare community is really stepping up and doing the very best they can to make sure that no one, or certainly as few people as possible, fall through the cracks.
So, Dr. Pate, one thing I find interesting about all of this is that St. Luke's at one point did try to buy Sulzer, but it was prevented from doing so. And I believe you were the CEO of St. Luke's when this happened. When this was blocked and St. Luke's could not purchase Sulzer, were you concerned at the time that this actually might end up being the future of Sulzer?
Oh, yeah. So I was the CEO at the time. And what few people know or understand is that we were not trying to acquire Sulzer. Sulzer actually came to us. And I want to give great credit to Dr. John Kaiser, who was the leader of that group, an OB-GYN physician. And his group had been doing forecasting and projecting how was their business going to do. And what their conclusion was, is it was not sustainable under the current scenario. And that is that Medicare reimbursements are not going up, or they go up by a hair. commercial reimbursements. There was pressure on those. So the revenues streams was not going to be going up much. Yet all of their expenses, salaries, supplies, all of that was going up at a much faster rate. And they were having challenges in recruiting new physicians. And as they looked at things, they, and it's interesting because this is about 10 years ago that they approached us, and they were looking out at their 10-year horizon thinking, we're not going to make it under these conditions. We need to do something different. And at that time, I had been talking about, I wanted to change our model at St. Luke's to value. St. Al's was persisting with the current model. And so Salser spoke to both of us to understand our strategies. They decided, they thought our St. Luke's strategy was the best fit for them, and they asked us to acquire them. We did all the due diligence, legal due diligence. We were told it was low risk. We decided, okay, we'll do it. And then St. Al's sued us to stop it because they didn't want us to have the group. And then they got the government to join them. So they all joined in the suit. And unfortunately, this was the first antitrust case of this type. There was no existing law to tell us how this would come out for sure. And there were many new aspects of it, but we pursued it. We lost. We had to sell off the group, and we tried. It was very difficult, frankly, because the judge said not only could St. Luke's not have it, but St. Al's couldn't either. And so we tried to find buyers. We did get some help locally that we were very grateful for, with Dr. Tommy Alquist stepping in temporarily, but then tried to get someone. We got a company from out of state. But, you know, unfortunately, they had a change in leadership, their priorities changed, and now Salser is back where they thought they were going to be. And so, no, it's not surprising. Unfortunately, our antitrust laws, they allow exceptions when somebody's imminently, their business is going to fail, but they don't have an exception for a situation like this where it's going to fail, but it may take years.
And with that said, then, do you think this is a sign of the future? Because it just seems that more and more smaller and mid-sized health groups cannot keep up. And so they are folding, or they're being folded in to bigger hospital systems.
Oh, absolutely. And this trend has been going on for a while. It is very hard for physician groups to be self-sustaining. It also is not just them. We are seeing record numbers of small hospitals fail around the country. The current model just doesn't work real well. Something's going to have to change. That's why at St. Luke's, when I became CEO, we changed our strategy. We're trying to go to value, to a more sustainable model. And we, in fact, a lot of small rural hospitals came to us. Again, we didn't approach any of them. They came to us saying, our future, we're not going to make it either. We want to join a health system. We'd rather be with you. And so we allowed them to join us. But yes, this is a trend that's already occurring across the country and likely going to accelerate.
Dr. Pate, we missed the actual anniversary, but we wanted to point out it has been more than 4 years now since we started bringing you on Idaho Matters. Back at the very start of the COVID-19 pandemic, I had no idea that this is what we would be doing 4 years later. How about you?
I thought maybe we'd be doing it 4 months. I never thought 4 years. And of course, I didn't expect all the disinformation, all the vaccine resistance, so many things that undermined our ability that we could have actually gotten rid of this virus back in 2020 and not have to continue to deal with it. But here we are.
Well, and we need to point out to all of our listeners, you do this for free. You are not compensated at all. And you give so generously of your time to come on the program. And with that said, I know you always tell us kind of anecdotal stories of people that you meet, who have heard you on the radio. I'm curious if there's any one particular story that sticks out to you, and do you feel as if you have been able to make an impact in these last 4 years?
You know, Gemma, it's been an amazing experience because at times I thought, you know, no one's listening, nobody cares. Mm-hmm. But yet I would hear everywhere I went from people. One time I was at a doctor's office with my wife, and I had to step out to get a call. And another patient in the waiting room asked my wife, "Is that Dr. Pate?" Because I had my mask on and everything. Uh-huh. And she said, "Yeah." And she said, "Oh, I listen to him all the time." And then probably the most memorable situation was about 2 weeks ago. I was out in front of my house doing some work, and a woman came by with her dogs, and she said, "Are you Dr. Pate?" And of course, I never know which way this is going to go, uh-huh. but I said, "Yes." And she said, "I just want you to know I'm an anti-vaxxer. I was raised by anti-vaxxer parents. I had not had any of my vaccines as an adult, and I hadn't gotten my children vaccinated, but I have been listening to the show on Boise State Public Radio. And the fact that you have not made us out to be bad people or stupid people, but you've just presented us with good information and told us the reasons we should think about getting vaccinated and all." She said, "I now have all my vaccines," wow, "including my COVID vaccines, and I've gotten my kids all up to date. And I just want to thank you for what you're doing." And I was just totally blown away.
Well, and that's what makes, I think, doing this so impactful, right? Is it's those moments where you're like, oh, people not only do listen, but you know, we're giving them information and education so that they can make their own decisions. And you know, I'm curious about, what do you think over these last 4 years since the pandemic started, what have we learned or not learned that you think is the most important things to come out of the pandemic?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things I'm afraid we haven't learned, which is the reason that Dr. Epperle and I wrote our book that came out last year, because we wanted to capture all these learnings and lessons and try to help others to learn from those lessons. But I do think that especially relative to this show, Jim, and I want to throw this back to you and those that run the station, you know, doing this show is just such a huge public service. What I found from talking to people is there's so much garbage out on social media. And this is our first pandemic where social media was really such a major influence. Mm-hmm. And people were confused. And some people were being scared by people giving out disinformation. And to know that there was a reliable site where they could go for their news and for updates and to understand, and especially the feature of this show where you let listeners write in questions so that they actually, if there's something they want answered, they can get an answer to it, has really been important in terms of offsetting a lot of the disinformation. I am perfectly fine if people don't want to get a vaccine, if people don't want to take precautions for themselves, that's their choice. But what really motivates me and angers me is when other people who want to do the right thing are being deceived and tricked into not doing the right thing. Those were the heartbreaking cases that we saw at the hospitals where people mm-hmm. came in and they were like, how did mom or dad or husband or wife get, or grandma or grandpa get sick? They were taking ivermectin. They weren't supposed to get sick. Well, that doesn't work. And can we get the vaccine now? But they're critically ill. No, it's too late. Those are the heartbreaking stories. And the fact that we were able to help so many people sort out truth from not truth and hopefully make better decisions, I think that was a great lesson learned. Otherwise, I'm afraid that we're not much better prepared. And I hope And we can even talk on a future show about things that we should be doing that we're not doing. We already talked about some things with the avian flu, but there's much more to do. And I am very encouraged. I just got a contact before the show of a national leader who's going to testify to Congress. And he was actually asking if he could use parts of my blog and the book. And so I'm hopeful that maybe we're going to get more attention about what are the things we need to do.
Yeah. Well, and I think you make such a good point that, you know, when we open that up for people to be able to ask questions, I think that was so critically important. And it still is now, right? We've expanded it to be public health because it impacts all of us. And so the more knowledgeable we are, then make your decision based on that knowledge. It doesn't mean we all have to agree on what those decisions are, right, Dr. Pate?
Exactly. But if we could just agree on what the facts are,
right,
and then you can make, you know, we should trust people to make decisions for themselves. They can, but they have to have the right information. If we're lying to them or manipulating them, as was the strategy of some disinformation purveyors, that's not good. That's tricking people. That's deceiving people. If people want to be deceived, fine. If people don't want to follow the advice, fine. But for everybody else, you got to give them the facts and good information and then let them decide the risk for themselves and decide their decisions for themselves.
Well, Dr. Pate, honestly, we here at Boise State Public Radio cannot thank you enough, truly, for all of the, first off, all of the time you have given to us. And then we take your expertise, your knowledge, all of the research that you do, that you have given all of us over the last 4 years. And as I said, you've done this for free. I want people to understand that. This is volunteered time. And you continue to do this. You continue to show up. And we are just so grateful for everything that you've done to provide critical information, in particular during the pandemic, but as we are moving into other public health issues, that you are still here showing up for us and doing your best to make sure that our community is educated and informed. So honestly, we cannot thank you enough. I mean, I know we give you a pair of socks every once in a while, Dr. Pate, but I'm really glad you appreciate the Boise State Public Radio sock.
Well, I also got a coffee mug, so don't.
Oh, good. Okay.
But I am humbled by that, Gemma. Thank you so much. I that makes it all worthwhile. And I want to thank the listeners. I can't imagine how hard it is going through something like this if you're not an expert in all these areas. And so thank you for tuning in to even make this worthwhile doing. And of course, you know, the way that we defeat the disinformation is by having this show. It costs money to have the show. So thanks to the sponsors who fund this segment. And thanks to everybody that donates to the public radio so that we can continue to provide this information. And I'm very grateful.
Well, Dr. Pate, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. We've been talking with Dr. David Pate. He is the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. Remember, if you have public health questions for Dr. Pate, you can always send them to us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.